A housing task force makes recommendations. An education study committee backs away from a controversial proposal. Plus Tom McDermott's podcast and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 28th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, a state housing task force recommended more than a dozen policies aimed at helping address Indiana's affordable housing crisis. The spotlight now turns to the legislature, which can further develop and enact those policies in its upcoming session. The recommendations include tax incentives for first-time and low-income home buyers, state funding for housing infrastructure, incentives for local governments to relax zoning and design standard regulations, and addressing substandard housing. Republican Representative Doug Miller, the task force co-chair, says the group's final report isn't perfect, but he says its work can help him make the case to other lawmakers that now is the time to act.
As a state, we're blessed with funds, right? We're blessed with jobs. We're blessed with growth.
Democratic Representative Cherish Pryor voted against the report. She says there was an imbalanced focus on building new housing.
But we also have to protect the people poor renters. We also have to protect the people who currently have housings that are getting outpriced because assessed values are going up so much.
The legislative session begins in January.
Swing hammer.
Can these recommendations get through the General Assembly? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, when we're talking about, there were particularly conflicts still at this meeting even between a lot of the panel, which was builders and realtors and stuff, and then local governments. When we're talking about conflicts with local government in the General Assembly, do these changes have a shot?
Well, I think they have to. What you're trying to address is a statewide problem that requires very local action, right? And so you've got to create an incentive for that. And that's what Representative Miller and the task force are attempting here. Now, in terms of like preemption, it's not mandatory preemption. I mean, you have communities where you go to Carmel and go, hey, you have an affordable housing crisis. They're like, we know. That's the result of like 3 decades of doing that on purpose, right?
Yeah.
And they're not interested in creating an opportunity for affordable housing. But there are communities that are. And there's communities that may be attracting. There's other parts of this puzzle, too, where you're attracting employers that need employees and talent, and they need to be approximate to the investment they're making, right? And create a workforce. So there's other reasons to do this. But if a local unit of government says, look, that's not our priority, then life just goes on as usual.
Yeah, talking to Doug Miller after this meeting ended, he said, this dovetails perfectly, he said, with what Governor Holcomb does on a day-to-day basis, which is trying to attract companies and people to Indiana. We can't do that if they don't have places to live that are affordable and attractive. They are talking about incentives, not mandates, which
right.
is important.
Right.
Can this be enough to get some of these local governments to go, okay, maybe we do need to think about this differently?
Oh, I think it could be. It depends on how much money they put behind it and what are the size of the incentives and the infrastructure contributions made to this. But yes, I think it could work. I think those are good, well-thought-out recommendations. They don't get to the fundamental problem. I mean, the fundamental problem is we don't pay our workers enough. We don't encourage collective bargaining for our teachers. We certainly have right to work laws here. And people are not making sufficient money to do this through the market, which is the way this is supposed to work, which is the way the Republicans say they always want things to work. But we don't want to address that problem of how poorly our state employees, our teachers, and in many cases, our retail workers are paid. And so the consequence is, yes, they have to have a place to live if they're going to come here at all. And I think this is an approach that can help with that. And heaven knows we need it. I mean, our shortage is almost 500,000 units.
Yeah, it's unbelievably bad. I think Doug Miller cited at the first meeting of this task force that at the current pace, even if nothing else changed, it would take 20 years to catch up to the amount of units that we just basically need. Given the scope of that crisis, we have all these numbers. This task force went through a lot of data from just about every stakeholder involved. Is that the kind of thing that can finally spur action in the General Assembly?
Well, I think we're kind of, you know, we're at that crisis point, the tipping point on this issue. And you know, they did have some bills a couple of the last year, a lot of preemption bills, like you mentioned. Those got extreme pushback. So it looks like they're now going to try the sort of carrot approach, at least in terms of local regulations, you know, requiring two-car garages and stuff like that that just kick up the price of new construction. I do think it's interesting that, I mean, we have, obviously we need some additional housing stock. We also have existing housing stock, and there was really nothing in there about that till the very end when they added, you know, a little bit of whether things are habitable and
yeah,
you know,
the substandard. Housing,
so,
right.
Because, I mean, obviously existing housing stock matters too.
Yeah. So, 16 recommendations, that one got added. Almost none of them, or very few of them, I shouldn't say none of them, very few of them addressed existing housing. It was almost entirely looking at building new housing, whether that's homes or apartments. Well, yeah, and so a lot of it seemed geared towards the Indiana Builders Association and things like that. Are we risking a too narrow a focus on a really large, you know, problem?
Well, and as you pointed out in your intro, that was why Cherish Pryor had concerns when she voted against the recommendations. I think, you know, somebody pointed out this week this may be the housing session, and I'm beginning to think it may well be, because the forces are really converging here on bringing that crisis to, I don't know, to some sort of explosive. We talk about catalysts on this show that we may be at that point. But that doesn't mean it's an easy solution. I think where we've come is, and this task force seemed to do good work. I mean, adults at the table looking, they were lauded by Senator Fadi Kudura as far as being bipartisan and cooperative and listening to that 16th proposal that you alluded to was his.
Yeah, that happened in the moment.
He added it at the last minute and earned a significant praise from him. So let's give him credit for that. But recognizing a problem and saying we're going to try to do something about it is still not the same as the specifics. And what the problem is here, and you've all touched on this, it's the cross currents that run through so many veins of Indiana politics and national politics. The notion of free market, we don't pick winners and losers, let the market forces hold sway versus a regulatory climate that forces the issue. That's
the recognition of, yeah, this is a serious problem we need to address.
It is.
I don't want them to build an apartment building near my house, though.
Oh, it's a major NIMBY issue. And then you have the issue.
Congress is contentious. Go to a BZA meeting.
I mean, that's one of the points of contention. The other one is state control versus local control. I mean, these are the themes that come back in various forms and on various issues year after year after year. And we also heard about the cost of houses that can be attributed to regulation. So a lot of people would say, let's get rid of regulation, but you know what's going to happen as soon as you get rid of the regulation. It seems to me that the very concerns about substandard housing and repairs that aren't made and safety issues that aren't addressed, that seems to be in conflict too. So you just have issue after issue.
We heard this is, yes, that regulation can be attributed to something around 26% of the cost of a new home.
If you talk about
apartment buildings, it's like 40%. But we heard that a lot of that is actually federal regulation, and then a significant chunk is state regulation, and then a much smaller chunk is local regulation. But then they also talk about the regulation that they feel like we could get rid of, the thing about you have to have a two-car garage and you can only use this type of siding because of the way it looks or things like that. That mostly comes from the local level. So that's the one you have to attack because you can't afford to get rid of a lot of the others. So it just keeps going around.
If mortgage rates are 10%, it may not matter.
Well, I'm sure you get a good deal on asbestos tile or shingle and lead paint. But
to me, the biggest thing that I thought that I heard that something the state can do was, and this is, I think, maybe the first recommendation, is a revolving loan or grant fund to subsidize the cost of the infrastructure. So you're building a housing development. The builders are paying to hook up everything to the sewer system that's part of that city. And that significantly increases the cost of that house.
Right.
If you can make sure that isn't passed on to the consumer, which You would hope it's not.
I bet it gets more expensive. What do you bet?
Well, and the flip side of that, to Cherish Pryor's point, is you have housing which is already hooked up to the sewers,
yes,
already has streets, already has sidewalks, and we can rehab that.
Now, that was one of the recommendations, like talking about maybe brownfields, which is part of that, which is we have the existing hookups. We just need to make it easier for people to build on those, and so hopefully that's another
one. And don't
one
forget, we have a General Assembly that not too many years ago fought vigorously to ensure that tenants in rental properties didn't have the rights to go toe-to-toe
yeah.
with their landlords. So there's
farmers.
A lot of, again, it's a lot of points of contention, a lot of issues.
We'll see how it shakes out. A panel of Indiana lawmakers this week approved recommendations that include streamlining school data, emphasizing work-based experiences, and integrating financial literacy into coursework. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comber-Weilen reports the Education Study Committee also removed one controversial part of its report.
Under current state law, administrators are required to talk with teachers about things such as class size, pupil-to-teacher ratio, and supervision of students. The biggest change made to the final committee report was eliminating language that recommended removing some of those requirements. Representative Vernon Smith says this discussion law is important, as is.
A lot of the improvements in schools have come through the negotiations of the collective bargaining unit with the administration.
Chairman Bob Boehning removed this language in an effort to push the recommendations forward.
And Delaney, recommendation or no, have we gotten a preview of what Republicans are going to try to do this session?
They can't even agree on the statewide test that can look at what we're doing to students. And the idea that you can have bargaining on salary only and not talk about class size and not talk about teacher-student ratio student discipline, which can be the biggest problem for teaching, is ridiculous. I mean, if we're either pro-education or we're not, and that clearly Mr. Boehning is not. I mean, it's the Democrats that took that provision out, and it requires them not to bargain on it, just to talk about it. For goodness sake, what is the harm in that? To know how it affects teachers. I mean, we have so many obstacles to getting our students up to par nationally. And it seems to me if we could focus on that and stop trying to make war on teachers, we'd be a whole lot better off as a state.
We have a teacher crisis in Indiana like we do in most parts, if not all of the country, where we just do not have enough teachers that we need. Is something like this, assuming it comes back this session, is something like this helping that, or is it hurting it even further by saying, well, now we're going to, you can't even talk with the administration about student discipline?
Yeah, I think part of this, I think it was poorly done, but I think part of it was, should we relocate some of these requirements? Is that the right time for the conversation? There are other requirements and things do we put that at licensure? Do we put it, so we can better collect data? Do we ever look at these old requirements? I talked to one superintendent this week who said, we still have to do an HIV committee from the Ryan White era. None of them do it, but it's still in the books.
Yeah.
So part of the complaint was we have all these requirements that go back decades, and we never really look at them. Is that the right place to have that conversation at the bargaining table, or is the right place to have that in some other forum?
If this pushes forward, does that message, if that's what this is, does that message break through and does that ratchet down the tension?
No, I think what it would evolve into is simply a labor dispute. It would be cast in very simple terms, and that is Republicans, anti-labor, organized labor, anti-collective bargaining, wants to empower the school boards to run their schools as they see fit, and then you have labor unions, ISTA and others saying, this is an attack on yet another attack from Republicans, whether it was various aspects of over the years, right to work. You can all cite the various chapters in the saga. And that's how this will be portrayed, and probably not inaccurately.
Allow school boards to decide what's going on in their classrooms unless it comes to what materials are in the classrooms. Then the state will decide that. But, there's a lot of debates about education that are probably about to come up at the State House for this session. The amount of funding, more teacher funding, the school funding formula looks to be in the cards again. Do Republicans need to, I mean, is it just easier to, at least for a session, let this one go?
Yeah, I mean, they have enough on their plates just doing a budget and trying to figure out and make sure each school is, you know, getting what they need. There was a recent meeting on complexity to try to figure out ways to help schools with a lot of at-risk children. I mean, I think those issues are the ones they really need to be focusing on. I'm not sure all, the only thing that this does is create, you know, yet another conflict between, you know, teachers and administration. And I'm not, your explanation sounded great, but it wasn't how I understood it. So, but I mean, I don't understand what's wrong with actually talking about class size. That seems like a...
Or discipline.
Yeah.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question, should the legislature further restrict teacher collective bargaining rights? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you for a prediction, who's going to win Indiana's U.S. Senate race. 42% of you said the incumbent Republican Todd Young, 53% say Democrat Tom McDermott, 5% say Libertarian James Siniak. I bet if you flip the McDermott and Young numbers, you might get the final results come election day. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Indy Star reported this week that Democratic Senate candidate Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott's for-profit podcast company has run ads for companies that do business with the city he oversees. McDermott launched his Left of Center podcast more than 2 years ago, and he said that if he wins the Senate race, he'll continue doing it, in part as a way to stay connected to constituents and allow them to hear from him directly. The Indy Star report says that a review of the podcast's 6 seasons showed hundreds of ads for companies that do business with Hammond. That's raised concerns over conflict of interest, though McDermott told the Star he's been nothing but transparent during his time as mayor. Nikki Kelly, there's certainly an appeal for McDermott to have a well-listened-to podcast, but is it also a problem for him?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, and the reason it's a fair question is it's not transparent, and that's what it's all about, right? Is we don't know what they're paying for that, and if they're getting any, you know, response. I will say he's got further issues. We reported this week that in addition to that, which we don't actually know how much money he's taking in, we have to base it on their things. He's accepted $330,000 in campaign finance donations from contractors who got contracts with the city of Hammond. So, I mean, that alone is at least that's transparent, though. This other situation with the podcast isn't.
Is this more of a, it feels like, especially in the podcasting space, where it feels very new, even though the fundamental issues here are not new to government at all. But it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll do a podcast. And then it was fairly successful. It's been doing well. They've done 6 seasons of it. Is it running into a problem of they just didn't think about these issues at all?
I'm guessing that may be the case. You've pointed out in conversation that it sort of has progressed in terms of its quality and its professionalism in terms of the production values and so forth from when it started. So I think let's assume that this was sort of a seat of the pants operation at the beginning. It caught on, as you suggest, and they're catching up, trying to just stay on the bucking bronco. That's certainly the most generous explanation. I would still say, however, though, when you have a public official, somebody in his sphere should have noticed that and should have said, this is a problem. It's a perception problem. Illegal, not, you know, regular.
It's not illegal.
I know.
It's not illegal, but
it is
a perception problem. At the very minimum, it's a perception problem. Even if there isn't any pay for play going on.
Well, that's like the contributions, Nicky was saying. That's not illegal either if that happens.
Should it have been thought about a long time before he started running for the U.S. Senate?
You know, maybe, and maybe he shouldn't take any money at all from it. I don't think they are taking any money out of it, but, you know, I don't know. The explanation that his spokesperson gave of pearl clutching I thought was really good because I didn't hear all that much angst out of the Republicans when Diego took, what was it, $43,000 out of his campaign account to buy himself a car, you know?
So you drive
how is that? That's legal, too. That's legal, too. Okay.
They all do
but
it.
That car will stay with him after the campaign's over.
It'll belong to the campaign.
Yeah, I'll bet.
No, it does.
Yeah, I'm sure it does, and he will be the campaign.
Is part of this issue, too, that when it comes to local government especially, it feels like there's so much stuff that goes on that is not... It's not illegal. Maybe it's not even wrong, but it doesn't feel great. It doesn't, or at least it doesn't look great.
You can't govern by that standard, though. I mean, it's about time the legislature got in there and said, what is and what isn't legal. I mean,
will this be a catalyst for major campaign finance reform in the General Assembly?
Maybe the car might be.
Well,
who
I mean,
knows?
I'll say what I said about Diego to begin with. It'd be weird if he didn't buy a car to drive around and do a statewide campaign. That would have been the weird thing, not the buying of the car.
Who was the first? Who bought
and they all
last
do.
One of those?
They all
who,
do.
Who?
All of us. Have you worked on a statewide campaign where you didn't own a car?
And we didn't buy a car.
You were a statewide candidate. You didn't have a car.
RV out
there. How'd you get around?
I had my own car.
local campaign finance is the Wild West. It just is in Indiana. It's never been addressed. It's not transparent. Even the parts that are filed and transparent are hard to go to the courthouse and get it, get the paper.
Yeah.
Unless you have a county that's just a city that's really trying to be transparent. So it's not
transparent. And not in real time either. So.
You said he was transparent. Maybe he was. It sounds like he wasn't that transparent. The companies are the companies. They're branding themselves on the podcast, so you don't know what they're actually paying them. You only know about the contributions, really, that they're making because of being a federal candidate is so it's so transparent, burdensome way, in a good way, but it's a burden, and that's the only way you're going to find out about it.
And you won't do it if it were a state candidate,
because it gets less transparent.
They can transfer money from their campaign to them for their personal living expenses.
But that's transparent too. That's listed. I mean, it is.
Yes. Answer the fact, yes.
Nine school districts across Indiana are asking voters to approve an increase to their property taxes or continue a referendum tax levy in this fall's election. Most of the funding requests on the November ballot would go to paying teachers and staff. School districts are voicing concerns that voters may misunderstand the public question of whether to approve a property tax referendum. That's because last year, legislators passed a law that requires the question include the estimated average percentage of property tax increase paid to the school district if the levy is approved. Terry Spradlin is executive director of the Indiana School Boards Association.
The language is confusing and certainly misleading to taxpayers.
For example, the Metropolitan School District of Wabash County must list the estimated average percentage increase as 124.5%. School leaders worry voters will take that estimated amount for the much lower increase to their own property taxes. In that Wabash County example, the property tax increase would be 61%, about 50 cents per $100 of assessed value. John Schwannis, how big a problem will this be for schools?
Oh, I think it's a problem. I mean, they're already, it's a high hurdle because of inflation. We've talked ourselves breathless about the issues of costs and cost of living in this state. Hoosiers are hurting. So this is not the time to do it. But when you throw these kinds of hurdles in where you have to disclose, you might as well just say, have a little disclosure that says, shows your pocket being opened and some imaginary governmental hand coming in and taking money. I mean, it's tough enough as it is. I think it doesn't bode well for those referenda.
To that point, we've talked about school referendums here for the last, on the show before, ahead of elections, and saying, well, is the biggest problem that schools are going to face that they've gotten a lot of, or been told they've been getting a lot of money from the state, and so voters are going to go, well, you're getting all this money from the state. Why do you need us to give you more? Is the problem now going to be that everybody's telling you an economic downturn is going to happen tomorrow, and so you're just not willing to raise your taxes at all? Is that going to be a bigger problem than anything else?
Yeah, I found it funny over the years. These have been far more successful than I thought they would be because they're so local. I do think most of these places are doing a good job explaining exactly what the money will go for and whatever. But for whatever reason, lawmakers, even though they put this in the Constitution, they hate it. And I mean, the wording on that, in survey world, this would be a push poll, right? Like we're trying to
make people vote. It's misleading. It looks misleading.
Absolutely. No. It's very frustrating.
Some of the successful ones are about school security enhancements following shootings and so forth. So
but we haven't even seen that many.
No, none of that.
So,
that's not what they
mean. If a bunch of these get defeated this year,
which is what the legislature wants,
will it prompt any changes?
There's only so much you can do. They're not paying teachers enough. The schools locally are trying to have these referendi in order to cure that problem, and then the legislature interferes with that. When they took over funding for schools, they were supposed to fund them adequately. They're not doing that. They haven't done that during the entire time Republicans have been in control for the last 20-some-odd years. And it's time to let them... If the locals want to increase their taxes, in this case, what, 50 cents, $100 of the assessed value. If they want to do that, they ought to have the right to do that, and the legislature ought to stay out of it.
We've seen, bit by bit, lawmakers trying to chip away a little at how successful these referendums can be. They haven't had much success. Is this the one that's going to finally work for them?
They're so hard. I mean, they are so hard. You're putting superintendents in this impossible position to go to the community and make the case for this. So it's got to be transparent. They've got to make a clear case and draw a straight line from the increase in the tax dollar to what it's going to be invested in, whether it's teachers or buildings. But it's really difficult. And Republicans, this was our Republican concept to begin with. We'll adequately fund education. And but if you want to go beyond that, that's on you, community. Go raise your own taxes.
And communities
but
have done
we don't
it.
Interfere with that.
And then, when you successfully do that, it's like, well, you can't do it at that election. It's more likely to pass in that election.
Also,
you can't, it's got to say this in this. I do this for a living. You read that, and I'm like, I don't know what the hell that means.
And also exacerbates.
Is that almost going to go the other way, that people are just going to go, this is too confusing, I'm just going to vote yes
my
or
kids
no?
Are in, look, my kids are
all
in.
Right. Yeah, sorry, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.